It's always a bit disconcerting. I'm sure it's just a matter of happenstance, but it seems that every time my class is scheduled to start, I look out the window and all sorts of people are getting on the bus to leave. Anyhow, welcome to the fifth and, for this week, final session of my series on the Book of Revelation. You've been with me before, welcome back. And if this is your first session, you're kind of getting in on the end of the movie, but I'll be offering the series again next week. So if you're going to be staying over into next week and wish to start at the start, you can do that. My name is Charlie McConis. I'm very pleased to be on the teaching staff here at Holden. I live in Seattle. I teach in the religion department of the University of Puget Sound and work for the Church Council of Seattle on its Peace Task Force. And when I was invited to be part of the staff here, I thought that given the unique opportunity that Holden presents, where we're at leisure and in an unusual setting, to tackle an unusual and difficult subject, the last and in many ways most puzzling book of the Bible, the Book of Revelation, or the Apocalypse of John. And I've done that well aware that the two most frequent approaches to this book of the Bible are either to ignore it because it's much too difficult to understand anyhow, and I've been guilty of that approach myself, or to take it absolutely literally as an exact blueprint for what's going to happen in the very near future in human history. And I think that neither of those approaches to this last book is very helpful. And instead, I'm going to offer an alternative. I wish to emphasize that, again, that it's only one approach to helping us to understand this book, because if we do believe, as we all do, that it is part of God's inspired word, then surely there is a message there of importance for us. So to ignore it is wrong. And on the other end of the scale, I think to expect that this book will allow us to fill in our calendar of appointments for the next 3 years is also quite wrong. I am offering you an approach that I learned from a teacher of mine, Father Daniel Berrigan, Catholic priest and poet and peace activist. And it's Father Berrigan's perception, and I agree with him obviously, that one key to understanding this extremely complex book, not the only one, but one key, is to realize that the Book of Revelations was written by and for the very early church at a time when it was undergoing severe persecution by the imperial state of Rome. As far as we are able to determine, the book was most likely set down in this form around the years 90 to 96 AD under the Roman Emperor Domitian, who demanded absolute emperor worship, that he be worshipped as God, and really made an all-out effort to enforce that throughout the Roman Empire. And the result was the second, Nero had been the first to persecute Christians in a limited way around Rome. The result was the second and by far a more severe persecution of the early Christian church. And we have seen down through this week that as almost always occurs, the imperial state, when it challenged the early church, came at it with both a carrot and the stick. The stick was the threat of social ostracism, imprisonment, or even death. The carrot was, hey, sign on with the state religion. It's fun, it's interesting, it works. Who needs Jesus? And the early church was in the position of either saying no or being swallowed up by the imperial state of Rome. As we look at the last three chapters of this magnificent book, which is the subject matter for today, again, we have some of the passages that are the most famous, the most moving, and also the most troublesome. of the book of Revelations, as I'm sure you have rediscovered if you took the time to read through those chapters. We start out in chapter 19 with yet another one of John's tremendous contrasts. Just before we've had the tremendous fall of Babylon and the collapse and the plagues and the churches being persecuted through all of that, and we are immediately presented with a contrast of the glory of the triumphant church in heaven, and once again worshiping the Lamb. And it is, but again, it is made very clear that this triumphant church in heaven is gathered only at great cost, because it's celebrating the fact in verse 2 that the Lamb has avenged the blood of his servants. You can pass over these little phrases so easily in this book unless you are keenly aware of what suffering the infant church was going through at that point in time. And as you get farther on and the great union of the church with the Lamb, with Christ, is described as a marriage feast. And this calls up, of course, the marriage feast imagery in the Gospels. And in verse 8, the people who are allowed into this marriage feast are clothed in white garments. White garments in verse 8, the fine linen of these wedding garments. You remember in the gospel story, if you don't have that on, you can't get into the wedding. It's like a fancy restaurant, right? You haven't got a suit and tie, you don't get in. Well, the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints, that only those who have endured and who have said no to the beast are part of the marriage feast. And the latter part of that chapter 19, we are given a truly grisly and horrible image of the last battle with the powers of Satan and Satan's representatives on earth. And these are passages that have caused Christians a lot of difficulty down through the years, because they seem to paint an image of God or even Jesus as a brutal warrior God who's hacking up the enemies, just as in the Old Testament. It seems that John himself could envision only a violent end to events on earth, a real reflection of the fact that war has been with us down through history, and the only image that seems to be offered to us, even for the end, is a war. And yet I think as we look at that passage, there are some important points that are made, which is really that the war makers consume themselves. Again, that message is seen again and again throughout the book of Revelations, that the empire brings itself down, and that the final battle is a battle that is a backlash on the beast itself. And I think that we must also ask ourselves if this isn't the kind of God that sometimes we hope for. A warrior God who really smashes the bad guys. And we know that this is not the final image of Christ and of the Lamb. The image of victory in the book of Revelations is of the Lamb who was slain and defeats the beast through suffering and resurrection. And even here, the battle that's depicted, the main point that is clear we've made throughout the book is clearly a very symbolic one. It's almost over magically. In verse 20, there was going to be this whole war, and all of a sudden in verse 20, poof, it's over. The beast is captured, the bad guys are all dispersed in a real rout. And surely this kind of description must have been very encouraging to a church which was being martyred constantly and suffering greatly. So I do not think that we must find our consciences offended by the images in this part of that chapter. They are not, again, meant as a literal description that all of a sudden the loving Christ that we know of the Gospels has turned into a vengeful, hateful God. Perhaps a God of our own wishes at times, but we know very well not the God of the Gospel. And when we move into chapter 20, we get into very deep waters. Because chapter 20 describes clearly the events that are to occur at the end of time. That particular area of religious and theological doctrine which has the long name of eschatology, or the doctrine of the end times. And as in all apocalyptic literature, it's extremely important to understand, again, that these are symbolic images. And I don't mean to say by that we're going to sort of explain away everything or be wishy-washy about everything. What is meant to be said is that ancient peoples conveyed very important truths in symbolic imagery. When we say that this is all symbolic, I don't mean that, well, it doesn't really mean much. You can all just dismiss it. It's just a comic book kind of thing. No, we saw from the very beginning that this is a book written in imagery that is symbolic and intended to be so, and difficult to understand, and even meant not to be understood by certain parties, namely the persecutors in the Roman Empire. For instance, throughout apocalyptic, the term 1,000 years appears again and again and again and again, and clearly means, in this genre of biblical writing, a very long time. That's what that phrase means, a very long time. In human comprehension, 1,000 years, we can't even imagine it. For God, of course, it's a moment in God's sight. But surely not 1,000 years to be marked off on a calendar, so that we can say, well, clearly in the year 2084, that's when things are going to wrap up. This chapter contains, for instance, a notion that there will be a 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth together with the martyrs. And if taken in an absolute literal calendar sense, that passage has indeed led to a lot of trouble in the church history, where movements have again and again sprung up saying, okay, we're it. We're the martyrs that are going to reign with Jesus. He's going to show up soon, and we're going to take over everything for 1,000 years or so, starting with this town here. In the Middle Ages, there were several strong movements of that sort, particularly around the city of Florence in Italy, with very unhappy results. And indeed, right to this time, there are groups of Christians, and I certainly do not mean to belittle them, but I do believe they are mistaken, who take passages like this literally and wait for an exact 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth. I won't name groups. I'm sure you can think of small sects or denominations in our Christian experience who still hold that particular belief. Since the time of Augustine in the 4th century, I think that the most general interpretation of this passage, and the one that indeed holds the central truth, is that for a long time on earth, before Christ returns, the church, the community of God's people, will represent Christ's reign on earth. The entire history of the church, those of us who are the church here on earth, those who have gone to their reward and are the church in heaven, represent that very long time, as indeed it has come to be a very long time, and much longer than exactly 1,000 years, right? We do have a certain advantage here of hindsight, a clear indication, if we needed more than we already have, that these things are not to be counted off in an absolute literal sense. The important thing is again to notice that this reign of the church on earth is very clearly meant to encourage those, as in verse 4, those who had not worshipped the beast or its image. I think one can understand the importance of this vision for a church which was felt it was about to be wiped out. You know, when we say here that the thousand-year reign is meant to be the reign of Christ's church on earth, you know, your reaction is, you know, sort of, well, yawn, ho-hum, of course. You know, here we are in 1984, and, you know, and the church is chugging right along. Well, at the time this book was being written, to simply say that the church will reign on earth for a long time was a message of tremendous hope. Because at that point in time, it looked like, geez, they're about to wipe us out. Or if not wipe us out, scare us into submitting. You know, this is we're talking about 90-96 AD here, folks, 60 years after Jesus' death and resurrection, and it doesn't look good. The church is wondering whether it's going to make it through to tomorrow, right? And so what for us is a, well, of course, this thousand-year reign of Christ in the church is God's presence on earth. You and I have the luxury of sort of taking that for granted. And we should not, you know, we should not. There are, you and I know very well that there are places on earth today where that cannot be taken for granted at all. All of you, I'm sure, have already tried to figure out how the heck to spell or pronounce my name. It's Mekonis, M-E-C-O-N-I-S, that's Lithuanian. And in my native land, the land of my ethnic heritage, Lithuania, I mean, the church is hanging on by its eyelashes, by its fingernails. In other places in the Soviet Union, much more religious freedom is possible. Lithuanians are a stubborn, ornery lot who seem to be particularly good to saying no to whatever beast happens to be around. And in that instance, it's the domination of Russia over Lithuania. And as a result, the religious persecution is very severe in Lithuania, much worse, say, than in Poland, for instance, if you can imagine that. And so I am keenly aware in my own familial life that there are places in the world where people read the book of Revelations and say, there is a promise that the church will go on and will survive and will flourish. When we get to verse 9 in chapter 20, you have a vision of the end of the world, of a catastrophic end of the world, in which the final battle ends with fire coming down, and that is echoed in the beginning of chapter 21, that there has to be a completely new heaven and a new earth. And I think this is an important thing to talk about because it too is a subject, I think, of varying interpretations. One must understand that the early Christian church continued the development of thought about the end of the world that was prevalent in Jewish history of the time. And even in the Jewish belief of the time, there was no agreement on how the world was going to end. There were two camps. One camp felt that the world was so rotten that the only way the Messiah could reign was to wipe out the whole operation and start from scratch. And the other group felt that, no, there will be a rule of the Messiah on earth, a messianic kingdom for a while before the final victory of Yahweh. And of course, as we know, that was one of the difficulties that Jesus faced, the differing interpretations of who the Messiah would be in the Palestine of his time. And many people thought that the Messiah would be a conquering military hero who would literally throw the Romans out. And as we know, that was not the kind of Messiah Jesus was. Well, this split is echoed in this book, the Revelation of John, because on the one hand you have the one notion that there will indeed be an intermediate reign of Christ on earth, we believe ultimately in the form of the church, And on the other hand, the notion that in the end it's also rotten, it's got to be wiped out. And I think that, again, we must try to get at the heart of the message, which is that we are given the promise that God is the Lord of history, and that in the end, faithfulness to the gospel is what will count and what will be judged, however it is that that is to happen, because there are images both of a fiery destruction of the world, to end the world. You can find others of them, for instance, in Mark chapter 13, verse 31, or 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 7 and 10 to 12. But there are also non-catastrophic images of how the end will come, images of liberation, as in Romans 8, 21, or images of renewal, as in Matthew 19, 28. And I think, in other words, that it is not correct to read something like verse 9 of chapter 20 in the book of Revelations and conclude from that that in actual historical fact, the end of the world will absolutely be in a big ball of fire, and that's the only way it's going to happen. I think, for instance, that one of the serious misinterpretations that has affected some members of the Christian community as a result of this is apathy in the face of some of the problems of the world. There is a notion that, well, it's all going to go, pardon my French, to hell in a handbasket anyhow, so why be concerned about world hunger? Why be concerned about the nuclear arms race? Why be concerned about environmental disaster? The Bible says the world's going to go up in smoke, so let's sit back and wait for Jesus. I think that that is a very incorrect interpretation of some of the symbolic images in this book. The images seem to me to be, the heart of that book seems to me to be quite other, that we are to be faithful by saying no to the inhuman practices that occur in our world and struggle against them in the name of the loving God. So, again, the literal interpretation of this book has led to, I think, some very unfortunate events and practices in Christian history. The main message of that chapter is as we all believe as Christians, that there will indeed come an end to history as we have known it, and in that end of history, in whatever form it takes, we know that those who have been faithful will be vindicated and that God's justice will be evidenced. There will indeed be both God's judgment and mercy available for all who have ever lived. But to try and get specific about the form of that, is it going to be fire? Is Jesus going to come in on a cloud from the north or the south? Is, I think, a mistake. Finally, we are granted in chapter 21, surely one of the absolutely most lovely passages of the entire Bible. We can sit back in wonder at the magnificence of the eternal kingdom of God. And we're certainly treated to a taste of that in last night's Vesper worship service, where we are given a vision of the new heaven and the new earth that will really represent the culmination of God's promises to all of us. And if we look at that passage again in the light of the experience I've been talking about, you can understand what a beautiful and poignant description it is, because it's written for a church that is being martyred, a church that is being imprisoned, a church that is being socially ostracized. And in that context, can you imagine their reaction to something like verse 4? He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. These are passages that mean something to all of us, don't they? We all have can identify with all of that. And yet I think you can get a glimmer of understanding of how much they meant to people literally under the gun. You know, the notion that you are undergoing the worst of persecutions now, and remain firm, and you will come to the new Jerusalem, where that travail, which will last but a brief time, will be over. And indeed, that's in the positive sense. There is an echo, even in this marvelous vision of the new Jerusalem, of the negative sense, that in verse 8 of that beautiful passage, there's the negative. As the people who won't be in the new Jerusalem. And what's the first category? The cowardly. Right? The very first category. Those who, in the face of emperor worship, of the persecution of the state, of the guiles of false religion, couldn't hack it. And very next, the faithless, those who lost their faith in Jesus and went over to the other side. And then the whole list goes on down. Those are the ones who will not experience that joy. And it's very important to understand, you know, that other side of the message of promise. There is that this glorious vision, and at the same time, there's the clear understanding that that vision is for those who have earned it, those who have earned it, those who have paid the price for the entry into that new world, which is then promised. You can understand how I think Tom was referring to some of that marvelous imagery of the tree of life, and one of the most prominent forms of execution for early Christians was again some form or other of crucifixion, and they shared literally in the tree of the cross. Many of them crucified upside down in an X form. Of the cross, because crucifixion, as you know, or as you may know, in the Roman Empire, was a political form of execution for those who represented a threat to the empire. Now you say, well, wait a second, the church didn't. I mean, we weren't revolutionaries. The church was not the Parthians about to overthrow the Roman Empire. Aha! Did it not represent the most serious threat by its refusal to say that the empire is God's kingdom on earth? The final claim to legitimacy that the empire had claimed in those days is, hey, we're God, and what we say is God's will. And somebody over here who says you're not God, that's as big a challenge as the Parthian warriors running around with their bows and arrows on the edges of the empire. And so the notion that the tree of life is in the city, I think, was surely a very powerful and healing image for the persecuted early church. And lastly, we come to those series of promises, the reiterated promise at the end of this book. Chapter 21, verse 5, I make all things new, and then repeated three times in chapter 22 in verses 7, 12, and 20. Here is this suffering church undergoing all of this difficulty. It's been given this marvelous image of the glory to come, and three times, just in case anybody misses it, Jesus says, I am coming soon. I am coming soon in verse 12, what? I am coming soon, bringing my recompense to repay everyone for what he has done. Very clear message saying, are you being faithful down there or in here, whatever you, however you want to put that? I am coming. And verse 20 in chapter 22, surely I am coming soon. And what more fitting end to the Bible than that promise, I am coming soon, and the church's response, come, Lord Jesus, Maranatha, beautiful cry in response of the church. And as we have done throughout this series, I think it is incumbent on us to reflect on, you know, what is the meaning of this imagery about the final times and about the promise for us in our time and place. And I think that the final promise of Jesus, which ends the Bible, is the key, and so does Daniel Berrigan. He points out in his book that perhaps the best way to describe the church and the community of faith is that we're the people of the promise. Here's our setting, which, as we have discussed in the previous sessions, is surely different from that of the first century church, but not nearly as different as we would like to believe, right? We have discussed over and over again the ways in which our times, even here, we've talked about how, well, certainly Nazi Germany was like that, and maybe countries under communist domination, and in a place like South Africa. But we have discussed again and again ways in which, even in our own time and place, with our own state, which we love and yet which we know does things wrong and seems to want to increase its power, in our own culture, with its emphasis on hedonism and magical technology and cheap religion, idols placed before us in many, many ways, that we too face a situation similar to the early church. That on the one hand, there is a lineup of seductive distractions, and on the other hand, lurking in the background, perhaps, the potential for persecution, surely much less in this country than elsewhere, but if you try hard enough, you can get into plenty of trouble, I guarantee you, even with our own state. I can certainly testify to that. And in our own time and place, we hear that same promise. Do not fear, I am with you. I will return. I am coming soon. And the question then is, I think, are you and I really people of the promise? Do we really believe that? You know, here we are, we're beset with problems and difficulties and everything else, and as Elmer Witt was talking about in his sermon earlier this week, fears of all sorts of kind, worries about our own security, etc., etc. Do we really believe that promise? You know, do we really believe the promise in the ultimate sense that I will come, and in the immediate sense that Jesus is here with us? And Berrigan probes this in his book about the book of Revelation. It's called The Nightmare of God. He says, the book raises the question entirely, the question of faith. The promise, he comes. The response, come Lord Jesus. The promise heartens the community for the struggle, just as the struggle helps it understand the terms of the promise. The two must go together. For the church is constantly tempted to strike bargains in high places, to declare a false peace with the world, to become no more than a debased and humiliated, though outwardly flamboyant, figurehead, a resource an ornament, a unique, sought-after, courted whore. Oof, harsh language, huh? Harsh language. Revelation is thus a call to an austere, unworldly faith. In other words, Berrigan is saying, you know, if we believe the promise, are we behaving like people of the promise? You know, can we say we believe the promise if we are not engaged in the same struggle that the early church was? You know, are you and I saying no to the temptations of our time? Are we saying no to the forms in which the imperial state comes down on us in our time? And obviously for something like Daniel Berrigan, something like militarism and war making and the nuclear arms race would be one example, one that's very prominent in his mind. Are we indeed, we've mentioned others in this gathering, other issues. Are we living the ethic of the promise? Are we, in other words, fleeing the empire? We talked about that in the last class. Are we doing all those things that the early church has done? He points out that the camp of the saints, represented in the final chapters here, it can be found throughout the world. In the third world, we think of Christian communities at the risk of their lives, living the gospel. I'm sure all of you have had that kind of experience. We're in less dramatic circumstances, I think, but still very real. I think that a place like Holden offers you and me a chance to probe whether or not we are living an ethic of the promise. Whether or not we really believe so much that Jesus is with us now and will come as the Lord of history to stand up for the things we should stand up for at whatever personal cost they might mean to us. Whether or not we understand that the joy of the kingdom is only the flip side of suffering the cost of entry into that kingdom. Dan says, if we're people of the promise, we'll live an ethic of the promise. And he puts it this way, we must so live, you and I, as though Jesus were near, here in time, here and near in our own place, the very witness of our motives, our speech, our actions. We must live as if he is near, as indeed believes Dan, and so do I, and I know so do you, that he is near and with us, even in this class here at Holden. So the book of Revelations, for all of its strange and weird imagery, and its difficult passages, I think is the perfect book to end the Bible with. The book that says to us, if we are a people of faith, a people of the promise, we will live that promise out every bit as faithfully as that early church did. Because our times are like their times, and our God is their God. And I invite your own reflections on this matter. We have a good portion of time. If there's something in the book of Revelations that I have completely skipped over that's been bugging you the whole week, I'd be happy to try and pick up on that. So let's open it up for discussion. Yes?
I'd like to ask you a question about the Berrigans. They're no longer in prison, are they, the brothers? Are they out of prison?
Gee, with the Berrigans, that's sort of a question like asking,
you know, where's your Aunt Martha today? They were recently given a 10-year prison sentence. In 1980, they went into a plant that manufactures nuclear missile nose cones and poured blood on the nose cones and knelt and prayed as a witness against the nuclear arms race. And they were given 10-year sentences for doing that. And that conviction was overturned on appeal on the grounds that the judge was completely biased against them, and also on the grounds that their argument had merit. They had said that the law of the land says that in case of dire necessity, one can break a lesser law to prevent a greater danger. The example being, if you're walking down the street someday and you see a house burning, you can break into that house and to help save the people that are in it. It's against law to break into somebody's house, right? But if you see a house burning down, there's imminent danger, you can break in. And that's one of the arguments that they said. The world is in imminent danger of being blown to bits in a nuclear war because of the greater and greater production of these weapons, and we're going to enter this plant and try to stop it in obviously a very symbolic way. And the appeals court said this argument has some merit. And so the conviction was overturned, which is an amazing turn of events, certainly miraculous by legal standards. I am not sure whether or not the government is going to retry the case.
Was this book written before the imprisonment or after?
This book was written before that particular event. Obviously, the first chapter was written while they were in jail for earlier demonstrations. When the White House announced that it was going to engage in a large civil defense program, Dan and Phil and others climbed onto the lawn of the White House and began to dig graves, saying, this is what your civil defense program is worth. We might as well all just dig graves if that's what you're putting your hope for peace in. And so they were given jail sentences for that.
Marion
John Scram? Yes. Sure. Yeah, well, they're an amazing. The whole family is amazing. Yeah. Some other reflections or questions? Yes.
It just occurred to me that if I've learned anything, it's about grace. And the end doesn't hold up much hope for sinners, or doesn't give them a chance to repent.
I think that this book, you know, the setting I think is very important. We can understand the feeling of the early church when, you know, to be faithful meant perhaps even death and torture and imprisonment, and not to be faithful meant you got off scot-free. And so I think that this book is a very honest reflection of you know, of the early church, that you know, that there is justice, that there is justice, that it's hard to imagine that those who caved into the empire on the one hand would meet the same fate as those who were faithful under that kind of a circumstance. However, the book of Revelations is not the whole gospel. It's an important part of it, but it's obviously not the whole word of God. And surely we all believe that even someone who was a coward, you know, and betrayed the Christian community and worshiped the emperor and all of that, chance at the last moment of their lives has the chance to say, you know, God, forgive me for my cowardice. Please accept me, the sinner, now. And we know that the God we believe in would accept that kind of a person. But that probably wouldn't have gone over very well. You know, I mean, that's not the kind of message that community needed to hear. This is a book written by and for some very heroic people, and it was, you know, these are not people who are interested in hearing that things are going to be okay for the, you know, the sinners too. And then, you know, you must keep that in balance. You know, you must keep that in balance. That if this was the only approach that you had, I think you would come away with a very harsh version. This book harkens in many ways back to Old Testament themes, doesn't it? You know, and that's uncomfortable for us. But at the same point in time, ours is not a Casper Milquetoast faith. You know, we do believe in a merciful and loving God, but as Dorothy Day used to always quote Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov, saying that love is a harsh and dreadful thing at times. It means harsh and dreadful things, you know, occur. And I think that, you know, one of the crucial things here, as I pointed out before, is that not only is it important for us to understand the circumstances of the church in order to be able to understand this book, but that if we put ourselves in those same circumstances, then the book means different things too. The book means different things too. You know, I know that from my own experience, from the experience of my friends. I never cared much for the book of Revelations until I was in real trouble. And then all of a sudden, it really started to make a great deal of sense. Some other reflections or thoughts, or puzzlements about this most amazing and troubling and wonderful book. Over here, over here on the right side. We'll get to Ralph next. Yes.
I was going to say the 18th and the 19th verse of the last chapter. They bug me.
18 and 19 of the very last, of chapter 22?
Yeah, they bug me.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah, they're certainly not very nice, are they? No. But you have to understand that at this point in time, I mean, you know, the whole notion of written testimony, things like that, was quite different in the ancient times than it is now. I mean, nowadays, your big problem, if you write a book and it gets published, your big problem is nobody's going to buy it, everybody's going to go out and Xerox it. You know. Well, I know, that's what happened to my book. Somebody bought one copy and Xeroxed it. Back then, the problem was, of course, a forgery. And for the early church, this was a real. It was the whole notion when oral tradition finally got put down on paper. If you look through any good Bible and it has the notes, you'll see that there are lots of differences. And we have different versions. You know, in one version it says this, in another it says that. So there was a real problem in those times of people changing things that had been written down. And it got to be a serious problem for the early church. And there were many things written that were spurious, in which the church had to say, this is not the guy, you know, I mean, this was not just all of a sudden put together and published easily, you know. The church had a very difficult time deciding what's genuine and what's phony among writings. So that's a very harsh passage, but it's reflective of a very real problem at that point in the church's history, which was how to separate out, you know, the real word of God as passed on in the community. You know, screwballs would write bizarre stuff. If you think the book of Revelation is weird, you should read some of the non-canonical apocalyptic literature of that time. You know, it's a really, really strange stuff. You know, it has there's stuff, you know, has Jesus as a little kid, and some kid takes away his toy, and Jesus strikes the kid dead. You know, weird stuff like that. Yeah, you know, stuff that obviously bears no relationship to the gospel. So this is a harsh message, but it's a forgery and alterations and spurious documents were a real problem in the early church. There's another little hint of a real problem in these latter chapters. You notice twice John tries to worship this angel. Tries to say, oh, angel, you are really spectacular. And the angel says, no, no, don't worship me. Some people were really getting into angels. You know, we've always had this problem in the church, right? You know, we have a notion of saints, which is a nice enough notion, and then it gets carried too far. You know, people start worshiping saints. And the same thing happened with angels. You know, people started really thinking angels were terrific and started worshiping angels. And so in this book you see a little reflection of that. And John is, you know, is letting everybody know that it's a mistake to worship angels. Angels are just God's servants, messengers. So you see a lot of those little reflections.
But you see, at this point in time, I don't know whether you've added some things to the book of Revelation or whether you take some things away.
Could be. Could be. You never know. Yeah.
So you left it open. And that leaves me hanging in thin air. That's when I go take off and I don't have to take them.
That's it. Very good. Quite true. Quite true. Ralph, you had a question that got lost.
Yeah, I guess it's a little hard to formulated, but on the one hand, we have in Romans 13, you know, the government is the power of God to establish righteousness.
Yes.
We should obey it, for the powers that be are ordained by God.
Right.
Then in Revelation 13, you perhaps covered this because I wasn't here today, but you have the beast in Revelation 13, it's just the two chapters, Romans 13, Revelation 13. Which you can't worship.
Yes.
And then, but the point that even in Revelation 13, there seems to be an odd thing about a call for endurance and faith. Do you want to say anything about that? I mean, I think you worked it out for yourself.
Sure, sure. I think you've raised a very good point. The book of Revelation is about many things, quite clearly. But one of the things it is very definitely about is, it talks about is, you know, what attitudes should the believing community take towards the secular power, the state. And for very many Christians, when that question is asked, their first response and the response that they are very familiar with and have been taught is to go pretty immediately to Romans 13. And to say that we are taught there by Paul that governments are given their power and their authority by God and are to be obeyed as God's agents on earth in temporal secular matters. Just as the church is God's authority and agent with regard to spiritual and religious matters. And that's a fair and a true statement. But what is also very clear is that that's not the whole story. All too often, Revelations 13, the whole book of Revelations is overlooked. And the fact that that book was written a little later in time. Paul was writing at a point in time before the Roman Empire saw the very infant church as a serious threat. It became one quickly because we know what happened to Paul. But you have only a few years later a church discovering the reality that it is quite possible for a government to be the enemy. But if you keep doing things, you eventually get into trouble. Because what tends to happen is what happened to Ruth Young Doll Nelson. We start out doing small things, right? The things that we feel are helpful. You start out contributing to a fund to help a clinic in Guatemala. You pick up by writing a letter to your congressperson saying, I don't think we should send American troops to El Salvador. You get a little more active and you go visit your congressperson in his or her office, or maybe you even work in a campaign, and still these things go on. And then you find yourself at a point saying, I must say no in a more dramatic way. In a way that perhaps involves breaking a law, whether breaking the law by, say, hiding a Salvadoran refugee in your church, which increasing numbers of church communities are doing, because our government says they're not refugees. Grabs them, puts them on a plane, sends them back there, and they get shot. And churches here are saying, well, this is an area in which our government doesn't deserve to be obeyed. We will harbor, we will give people sanctuary, Salvadoran refugee sanctuary in our church. So there's a continuum there, and not everyone says no to the beast in that particular dramatic fashion, but there are many ways in which we can do that in our own lives. Simply not, I think it's done very well here at Holden, not trying not to use products that are contribute to oppression elsewhere. You know, check out your investments. You know, do you find out that your retirement fund invests your money in corporations in South Africa? Well, you know, there's a chance for you to say no to something that's going on. Put your money elsewhere. There are ways to do that. The question of taxes touches all of our lives, or most of our lives anyhow, in some way, shape, or form. It's nice to say, I don't agree with that, I wouldn't do it myself, but you're helping to pay for some things. Every year, once a year, you give some money. You know, they can't build those bombs for nothing. Somebody's paying for them, and it's you and me. So, I think it's very important to understand that as Christians, our attitude toward the state must be one of careful judgment, appreciation and obedience where the state is just and compassionate, and resistance where its policies are wrong against the ethic that we all believe in. But that, for me, the limit to that response, and I wish to make that very clear, the limit to that response is that that witness is at all times and places to remain consistent with that of the early church, a nonviolent witness. So I find myself at respectful odds with my Christian brothers and sisters who favor, for instance, revolution, armed revolution in certain circumstances. Well, I've overkept this. Thank you all so very much. Come again next week if you miss.